Hello, dear listener, and thanks for tuning in to today's episode of A Minder. I'm Nyla, and I'll be taking you through 16 peer-reviewed articles published in January 2022 on various non-pharmacological approaches to preventing, treating, or otherwise intervening in the effects of Alzheimer's disease. We'll dive right in after this quick introduction.
Welcome to A Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
So I've divided today's episode into five sections. On the roster, we have three papers on interventions targeting cognition, three papers on multi-domain interventions, two on nutrition, three on exercise, and then another five papers on stimulatory techniques. But before I take you through these latest studies, I just want to remind you that what we do here at A Minder is summarize the latest literature, primarily based on the abstracts that we find on PubMed. So we're not doing a deep dive or any sort of critique of the paper's content. Which means that if any of these papers are of interest to you, we highly encourage that you find them in our free bibliography and follow up on them later. I'll be providing the first and last author, the journal, the title, and I'll be numbering these papers throughout as well, so you can easily keep track. Without further ado, let's start off today's episode with a few papers on improving cognitive function. And this is either in people with mild cognitive impairment, which is MCI, or in Alzheimer's disease, either through directly training cognitive tasks or through some other innovative approaches. And the reason that I also cover MCI, by the way, is that this is thought to be a prodromal stage of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. So often people who have diagnosed MCI go on to develop AD or other dementias later on. So the first paper today is titled Effectiveness of a Year-Long Individual Cognitive Stimulation Program in Portuguese Older Adults with Cognitive Impairment. Unsurprisingly, this is coming from Portugal, namely the Polytechnic Institute of Beja and the Bridgewater State University actually in the US. So this is an international collaboration. The first author is Justo Enriquez, and the last author is Carvalho, and it was published in Neuropsychology, Development and Cognition, Section B, Aging, Neuropsychology and Cognition. In this study, the authors evaluated the effectiveness of an individualized cognitive training or stimulation, as they call it, program, which ran for 47 weeks and targeted cognition, mood, instrumental activities of daily living, and quality of life. And by activities of daily living, I mean things like getting dressed by oneself, taking a shower, eating, and so on. 59 older adults with Alzheimer's or other neurocognitive disorders were randomly divided into two groups. That is, 30 received weekly sessions of the cognitive stimulation program, whereas the remaining participants served as a control group that maintained their usual treatment. The participants were evaluated for cognitive function at baseline, halfway through, and 1 week following the intervention. The authors report that there were significant improvements in three standardized tests following cognitive stimulation, but you'll have to check the paper for more details. As you've likely experienced, scents can be very evocative. Our sense of olfaction has a powerful way of sparking memories with the slightest whiff of a familiar odor. The authors of paper 2 investigated whether this function could be harnessed for improving memory in people with mild cognitive impairment, that's MCI, in their paper entitled The Effect of Olfactory Training on Olfaction, Cognition, and Brain Function in Patients with Mild Cognitive Impairment. This is from first author Chen, last author Hena at Technische Universität Dresden in Germany, and was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. In this prospective study, 38 MCI patients were randomly assigned to participate in either an olfactory training program or a control training program twice a day for 4 months. The paper provides more details on the control group, but the olfactory training group included having frequent short-term exposure to various odors. The authors conducted a comprehensive neuropsychological assessment after the intervention and found that olfactory training had no significant effect on either olfaction or cognitive function. That said, it did increase activation of the frontal lobe, as assessed by magnetic resonance imaging, and the change in olfactory scores was positively associated with the amount of change in frontal lobe activity. This means there was an increased functional response to odor, but this did not seem to translate into cognitive benefits as assessed in this study. Another approach to improving the quality of life of people with MCI or dementia is to provide tools that can make up for cognitive impairment and memory loss rather than improve it directly. First author Shmita Edgecombe and last author Cook from Washington State University do just this in paper number 3, entitled Partnering a Compensatory Application with Activity-Aware Prompting to Improve Use in Individuals with Amnestic Mild Cognitive Impairment, a Randomized Controlled Pilot Clinical Trial. And this was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. The authors tested whether the learning and subsequent use of an electronic memory and management aid application, I'm going to call that the EMMA app, so whether that could be improved or enhanced by smart home prompting. This means that the app was accompanied with a real-time, activity-aware smart device in the home environment. The study included 32 adults with MCI who were randomly assigned to either learn the EMMA app alone or when partnered with the smart home prompting over a 4-week period. For 4 months following the training, the authors collected monthly questionnaire data and EMMA data metrics to assess the extent to which the participants kept using the EMMA app. They also tracked how the use of the EMMA app was integrated. When the app was paired with the smart home prompting, the participants engaged with it more times daily, using more of its basic and advanced features. This was already apparent by week 4 of the training, and the advantages were maintained over the study period. This suggests that the prompting technology helped in habit formation and long-term use of the device among individuals with MCI, although the questionnaire data suggested there wasn't a differential impact on daily functioning and quality of life. We'll move on to a few papers on multi-domain interventions, that is, ones that target various lifestyle factors at once to see whether this approach holds potential for preventing or slowing dementia. Let's start off with a meta-analysis, which will give us a lay of the land. So paper 4 is entitled The Relative Effectiveness of Different Combination Modes for Exercise and Cognitive Training on Cognitive Function in People with Mild Cognitive Impairment or Alzheimer's Disease, a Network Meta-Analysis. It's coming from Peking University in China by first author Zhao and last author Wan, and was published in Aging and Mental Health. So the authors used multiple academic search engines to retrieve papers about interventions combining cognitive training with exercise. They wanted to see whether these could be beneficial with people, or for people rather, with AD or MCI. And they specifically looked at randomized controlled trials, and all studies had to report on global cognitive function, memory, and executive function as outcomes. You can check the paper for more details about the inclusion criteria, but essentially they identified 20 articles, totaling 16 separate studies with nearly 1,200 participants total. The authors found that depending on the outcome measures, sometimes it was better to have the exercise and cognitive interventions be separate, such as for global cognition as an outcome, whereas for other measures like memory function, it was better to have an interactive modality. The authors state that separate and interactive combination modality had the highest probability of improving overall cognition and memory, but I'll admit that I'm not quite sure what is meant by this, so I recommend that you check the paper for what exactly this means. They also caution that there is insufficient data to draw conclusions concerning the best interventions for executive function. Hence, more research. Which brings us to paper number 5. We are back down to a single study for this paper, namely the Multi-Domain Alzheimer Preventive Trial, published in Alzheimer's and Dementia by first author Belleville and last author Ngandou. This is coming from my home city, Institut Universitaire de Gériatrie de Montréal and the Université de Montréal, and they also have partners in France and Finland. This was a 3-year randomized controlled trial in at-risk older adults that included an intervention combining cognitive training, physical activity, nutrition, and the inclusion of omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids in the diet. The study included 749 participants, and the relationship between the number of sessions they attended and improvement on global cognition, memory, and fluency was evaluated. The authors also examined whether this relationship was modulated by other factors such as age, sex, education, dementia score, frailty score, and apolipoprotein E4 status, so that is the most common genetic risk of Alzheimer's. They report that there were benefits of attending 15 to 20 multi-domain sessions, which amounted to 12 to 14 hours total of training, but that after that, the effect plateaued. So that means that attending more sessions did not improve cognition any further. Among those who benefited the most from the intervention were women, younger participants, frail individuals, and those with lower education or with lower risk of dementia. So these findings suggest that more is not always better, considering the optimal dose here was about half of the sessions that the participants could attend. Next up is paper number 6, which is entitled Multimodal Preventive Trial for Alzheimer's Disease, MIND-AD Mini Pilot Trial Study Design and Progress. This is by first author Cindy and last author Kivi Pelto, and primarily out of Karolinska Institute in Sweden. And it's published in the Journal of Prevention of Alzheimer's Disease. This paper reports on an adaptation of the Finnish Geriatric Intervention Study to Prevent Cognitive Impairment and Disability, that is the FINGER study, which I've reported on in previous episodes. In the current study, the authors evaluate whether adding medical food to the intervention could improve the beneficial effects of this multi-domain intervention in people with prodromal AD. The medical food is not specified in the abstract, but it's based on the LipiDiet trial, and so this includes lipids and other nutrients that are thought to decrease the risk of Alzheimer's. In this proof-of-concept 6-month randomized controlled trial, 93 participants with prodromal AD were recruited from 4 sites in Sweden, Finland, Germany, and France. You can check the paper for details on how prodromal AD was defined. The participants were divided into 3 groups. The first was the multimodal lifestyle intervention, including nutritional guidance, exercise, cognitive training, vascular and metabolic risk management, and social stimulation. The second was this whole multimodal lifestyle intervention plus the medical food. And the third was a control group that received regular health advice and care. Unfortunately, the abstract doesn't report much on the results, but the authors do confirm the feasibility and adherence to both the lifestyle intervention alone, as well as that combined with the administration of medical food. That brings us nicely into our next section, in which we've got 2 papers exploring whether certain nutritional components may have a neuroprotective effect in Alzheimer's. Let's start off in a mouse model of AD to have a look at the effects of probiotics with first author Tan and last author Lang from Qichihar Medical University in China. Paper 7 was published in the Journal of Healthcare Engineering, and the title is Neuroprotective Effects of Probiotic Supplemented Diet on Cognitive Behavior of 3XTG AD Mice. This study compared the effects of a probiotic supplemented diet on cognition and pathology in wild-type control mice and in 3X transgenic mice. This is a common mouse model of AD, and these mice usually show impairment on cognitive tasks. Specifically, the mice were fed either a regular diet or a probiotic supplemented diet over 20 weeks. When the mice were tested on the Morris water maze for spatial memory afterwards, the transgenic mice who had received the regular diet showed impaired learning as expected. Compared to their control transgenic animals, the ones that received the probiotic diet exhibited better learning and memory. The authors also went on to sequence genes from the feces of these mice to determine which microorganisms were present. They found that compared to the wild-type mice, the transgenic mice that received the probiotic experienced a change in their intestinal flora. They also had decreased tau and amyloid beta pathology, but I'll let you dig into the paper for the specifics on that. Overall, this suggests that inclusion of probiotics improved cognitive performance in this transgenic AD mouse model. You may have previously heard about the keto diet, and if you're like me, you may even have some friends that have tried to convince you that it's the way to go. Maybe you've even tried it yourself. There's still lots of research to be done on the potential health benefits of ketosis, so let's not jump to any conclusions. But this next protocol paper suggests that there's interest in looking at it in the context of AD as well. Paper 8 is called Ketone Ester Effects on Biomarkers of Brain Metabolism and Cognitive Performance in Cognitively Intact Adults 55 Years and Older. The title is not done. It's a study protocol for double-blinded, randomized controlled clinical trial. And this is by first author Avgerinos and last author Capogiannis. It's published in the Journal of Prevention of Alzheimer's Disease, and it's coming primarily from the National Institute on Aging in Baltimore. Previous research has suggested that oral ketone monoester can induce ketosis in humans, and that it may have therapeutic effects on cognition and AD pathology in animal models. In this upcoming study, the authors wanted to extend on their previous findings by investigating whether the ketone of interest can enhance brain ketone metabolism, improve cognitive function, and modify AD pathology in humans. They describe an upcoming clinical trial in which they will compare the effects of this ketone between cognitively normal adults over the age of 55 who have increased risk of AD due to having metabolic syndrome. And a brief side note here, metabolic syndrome is a cluster of conditions such as increased blood pressure, high blood sugar, and abnormal cholesterol levels, which have all been linked to an increase as well in heart disease and diabetes. So back to the study, the authors will be giving participants 25 grams of the ketone monoester or an isocaloric placebo. This will be 3 times daily over 4 weeks, and the authors will then evaluate changes in brain metabolism, cognition, biomarkers of AD, and in the microbiome. So stay tuned. That brings us to our halfway mark, so let's take a moment to stretch here before we get into our next section. I've got a few papers on exercise for you right after this little break.
I want to take a short break to convince you to join me and the editing team here at Aminder. We are responsible for the high-quality, polished episodes you hear, and our team is looking to grow so that we can cover even more episodes in a month. If you're interested in learning the ropes, send us an email at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. We do have other positions on our team if you're interested in those. I find it to be a rewarding auditory and visual challenge, and I love working behind the scenes to get the best out of our hosts. So if you want to feel like a superhero after editing out mistakes seamlessly, please reach out to me and to the Aminder team.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years. And sadly, no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration in Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Okay, we are back, and buckle in as we're about to take a trip to the molecular level in these next few papers. There's lots of evidence that exercise is neuroprotective in Alzheimer's and in other neurodegenerative diseases, but researchers are still investigating the mechanisms to understand exactly how physical activity improves brain function. So far, it seems to be a whole mix of factors, as you'll see in the next 3 papers. Let's start off with one that looks at synaptic plasticity, which is the cellular mechanism underlying learning and memory. Paper 9 was published in Cells by first author Mu and last author Zhao. from the Beijing Sport University in China and the Zhengzhou University, also in China. And the title is Treadmill Exercise Prevents Decline in Spatial Learning and Memory in the 3X Transgenic AD Mice Through Enhancement of Structural Synaptic Plasticity of the Hippocampus and Prefrontal Cortex. So as you just heard, we are back in the 3X transgenic mouse model for this study, but this time, rather than looking at the effects of a probiotic diet, the authors tested whether treadmill exercise could improve learning and memory on the behavioral level and also on the neuronal level through structural synaptic plasticity. 3-month-old transgenic and non-transgenic control mice were either subjected to 12 weeks of treadmill exercise or not, and the resulting changes were evaluated at 6 months of age. So that means that there were 4 groups, 2 of them transgenic, 2 non-transgenic, 2 of them exercising, and 2 not. The authors report that while the transgenic mice that did not undergo exercise had impaired spatial working memory at 6 months, those that did have exercise showed significant improvements. This was paralleled with higher number of synapses, synaptic structural components, and dendritic spines, increased expression of the presynaptic marker synaptophysin, and increases in axon length and dendritic or neuron branch complexity. These changes brought the transgenic AD mouse neurons on par with those of the healthy non-transgenic mice, although the authors also note that similar improvements were seen in the non-transgenic mice that underwent exercise. So what they conclude is that the strengthened structural synaptic plasticity could be at the heart of, or rather at the neuron of, the benefits of exercise on cognition. So what about the effects of exercise on AD symptoms beyond cognitive impairment? After all, Alzheimer's isn't just about cognitive decline. There are psychiatric, psychomotor, and sensory motor symptoms that can also occur and negatively impact quality of life. Paper 10 takes a look at one of these in the study entitled The Effect of Exercise on Early Sensory Motor Performance Alterations in 3X Transgenic AD Model of Alzheimer's Disease. This was published in the journal Neuroscience Research by first author Bahais and last author Tran, primarily from Bellarmine University and East Carolina University in the US. Here, the authors subjected 3X transgenic mice to 12 weeks of wheel running exercise to see whether it could improve both sensory motor symptoms and Morris water maze performance. Remember, that's a test of spatial learning and memory. As in the previous paper, these mice were compared to transgenic mice that remained sedentary, as well as non-transgenic mice that were either subjected to exercise or not. To test sensory motor function, the authors used the beam traversal task. They also examined spontaneous motor activity and evaluated the mice's ability to remove an adhesive. At 6 months of age, the sedentary transgenic AD mice exhibited freezing and unusual shaking or tremoring behaviors that were not observed in the non-transgenic control mice. That said, exercise reduced these unusual motor behaviors and also improved beam traversal and adhesive removal. The authors conclude that the observed sensory motor symptoms coincide with impairment on spatial memory and that they can also be mitigated by exercise. So if you've been attentive, you'll remember that I mentioned metabolic syndrome a little while back and how this increases both the risk of AD and type 2 diabetes. Well, type 2 diabetes is also a major risk factor for AD, and there's lots of research into how treating it could prevent or slow cognitive decline. So this time we're looking at a rat model of diabetes with paper 11, which is entitled Treadmill Training Attenuates STZ-Induced Cognitive Dysfunction in Type 2 Diabetic Rats via Modulating GRB10/IGFR Signaling. It's by first author Zhang and last author Cao or Ku at Wuhan Sports University in China, and it was published in Brain Research Bulletin. So in this rat model of diabetes, the rats are injected with streptozotocin, which is an antibiotic that destroys pancreatic islet beta cells and produces a type 1 diabetes-like effect. Here, the authors show that this leads to higher levels of growth factor receptor-bound protein 10, that is GRB10, in the hippocampus, and that likely underlies the defective brain insulin signaling. They also report altered levels of other metabolic factors in the brain, but I'll let you check the paper for details. When the rats were subjected to 8 weeks of treadmill running, the authors found that this reduced the abnormal GRB10 levels and also enhanced the expression of certain synaptic proteins, providing a nice little link to paper number 9. There are a lot more molecular details in the abstract, but I'll conclude by saying that this treadmill exercise also improved things on the behavioral level, namely by alleviating a deficit in spatial learning and memory. And this brings us to our final section, the last 5 papers of this episode, which I've lumped under stimulatory techniques. What I mean by this is neuromodulatory techniques, so things that stimulate brain activity that aren't pharmacological in nature. This usually includes repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation or direct current stimulation, but sometimes we get a couple other techniques in there as well, as you will hear today. So actually, we're going to start off this section with a paper on light stimulation. That is a non-invasive exposure to 40 Hz white light that has shown promise for reducing AD pathology in animal models, and it's being tested as well for therapeutic effects in humans. Paper 12 goes deep into the possible underlying mechanisms, so I'll keep it surface level and encourage you to follow up on the paper if you're interested. The title is "The 40 Hz White Light Emitting Diode, or LED, Improves the Structure Function of Brain Mitochondrial KATP Channel and Respiratory Chain Activities in Amyloid Beta Toxicity." It was published in Molecular Neurobiology by first author Nazari and last author Eliassi, and this is from the Shahid Beheshti University of Medical Sciences in Tehran, Iran. One of the potential contributors to the development of AD is metabolic dysfunction in the brain, and that includes in mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell. We have previous episodes and monthly bibliographies if you want to dig into this, but for the sake of today's paper, know that potassium channels in mitochondria might be impaired in Alzheimer's disease. The authors wanted to test whether a 40 Hz light stimulation could modulate the mito-KATP potassium channel in mitochondria in a way that could restore some of the regular functions of the mitochondria. This was done in vitro, that is, the authors looked at the channel in a cell bilayer lipid membrane. They first demonstrate that amyloid beta 142 toxicity, one of the hallmarks of AD, does indeed change this channel's function. Specifically, they saw a reduction in mito-KATP's permeation and a change in its subunit composition. The authors go on to report that stimulation with light increased the channel permeation and restored some downstream effects, or functions rather. This suggests that some of the beneficial effects of 40 Hz light stimulation might occur through targeting mitochondria. And if you would like to know more on this topic, you can check out this month's bibliography on mitochondria, oxidative stress, and metabolism. So onwards, the next 3 papers look at transcranial magnetic stimulation. This is a non-invasive technique that is currently under investigation in clinical trials, so it is at the human level at this point, and it's essentially regulating brain activity through magnetic pulses or magnetic stimulation. So paper 13 is entitled "Repetitive Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation Improves Brain-Derived Neurotrophic Factor and Cholinergic Signaling in the 3XTGAD Mouse Model of Alzheimer's Disease." We've heard a lot about this model in this episode. This time we're with first author McNerney and last author Yesevage from Stanford University in California, and this is published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So I'm going to abbreviate right away repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation to RTMS. And here we're looking at, again, in the 3X transgenic AD mouse model, whether delivering RTMS to the forebrain could support neuronal health, firstly by increasing cortical gene expression of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, and secondly by improving cholinergic signaling. So among other things, BDNF plays a vital role in synaptic plasticity, which we heard about in the exercise section. In this study, 12-month-old wild-type control mice, or the transgenic AD mice, received either a sham treatment, daily RTMS treatments for 2 weeks, or two RTMS sessions a week over 6 weeks. After the treatment, the mouse brains were analyzed by immunology and ELISA assays to see whether the RTMS stimulation altered AD pathology, BDNF gene expression, and cholinergic signaling via acetylcholinesterase and choline acetyltransferase. The authors report that both the 2-week and the 6-week regimens increased BDNF gene expression in the transgenic mice, although the more spread out 6-week treatment had a greater effect. Cholinergic activity, or more specifically, acetylcholinesterase activity, was also increased in the transgenic mice following both treatments. Interestingly, the RTMS treatment did not have the same effect in the wild-type control mice. The only change the authors observed was an increase in BDNF gene expression following the 6-week regimen. So these findings suggest that RTMS delivered to the forebrain does improve markers of neuronal plasticity and cholinergic function, and this was fairly specific to the AD mouse model, or the transgenic mice compared to the wild-type mice. And we've been talking a lot about synapses in this episode, much more than I usually do. If you like this topic, you can check out Anusha's episodes, specifically the latest one on synaptic mechanisms underlying AD, that is number 267. And you can check out upcoming episode 272, which is on pharmacological treatments targeting neuroprotection. So this episode has been full of positive effects in mouse models, but a big challenge in health research is translating findings from animal models to humans. Even when using the same treatment paradigms, such as RTMS, it can be difficult to know which outcome measures in an animal model correspond to clinically relevant changes in humans. Since we just looked at neuroplasticity in the context of the transgenic AD mice, let's jump into a paper that examines the effects of RTMS on plasticity in humans. Paper number 14 is entitled Cognitive Impairment via Left Angular Gyrus Navigated Repetitive Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation Inducing the Neuroplasticity of Thalamic System in Amnesic Mild Cognitive Impairment Patients. That was a mouthful. This is by first author Yang and last author Bai at the Nanjing University in China and was published in Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. In this study, 16 patients with amnestic MCI and 6 with AD were subjected to an RTMS treatment for 4 weeks in which the left angular gyrus was stimulated. The authors chose this brain region given that it shows a strong functional link to the hippocampus. The effects of this stimulation on neuroplasticity were analyzed by diffusion tensor imaging and graph theory analysis of the functional network. Have a look at the paper for the specific methods. The authors also examined cognitive function following the RTMS intervention, finding that episodic memory was improved in MCI patients and that both patient groups had improvements in the Montreal Cognitive Assessment scores. The findings from the diffusion tensor imaging showed that there were functional network changes in the thalamus, but this was only the case in the MCI group. The authors also report that the plasticity in the thalamic system was associated with the cognitive improvement and conclude that the therapeutic effects of RTMS in MCI patients may in part be through thalamic neuroplasticity. The authors of this next paper use another neuroimaging technique, namely resting state functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, to examine the effects of RTMS in patients with AD. Paper 15 is also coming from China, this time from Huaxiong University of Science and Technology, with first author Quinn and last author Zhu, and it's published in Neuroradiology. The title is Effects of Repetitive Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation Combined with Cognitive Training on Resting State Brain Activity in Alzheimer's Disease. The study included 17 patients with mild or moderate AD who were randomly divided into one of the two intervention groups. The first being real RTMS combined with cognitive training, and the second being a sham RTMS with cognitive training. So that is the control group. The stimulation was delivered at a 10 Hz frequency to the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, followed by the left lateral temporal lobe for 20 minutes daily and a total of 4 weeks. Besides neuropsychological testing, the participants also underwent resting state fMRI before and after the treatment, from which the fractional amplitude of low frequency fluctuation, or FALF, was calculated. And from my understanding, this is a measure of spontaneous neuronal activity that is often used in resting state fMRI. The authors found that FALF, so the spontaneous neuronal activity, was increased in the RTMS treatment group following the intervention, but not in the sham group that had just received cognitive training. The paper has more details on which brain regions showed this increase in spontaneous activity. But essentially, there was an increased functional connectivity between the right cerebellum, or declive, and left precentral / postcentral gyrus. Some of the region-specific changes also correlated with the observed improvement in cognitive function, leading the authors to conclude that increases in low-frequency fluctuation of neuronal activity and in functional connectivity could underlie the cognitive benefits of RTMS. That brings us to our final paper of the day, which is actually quite a departure from all this talk of light and magnetic stimulation, but it brings us back to targeting the cholinergic system, which we also looked at in an RTMS study a few papers back. Paper 16 brings up a brand new topic for my prevention and intervention episodes, namely osteopathy in rats. And the title of this paper is Cranial Manipulation Affects Cholinergic Pathway Gene Expression in Aged Rats. The first author is Ananda Krishnan, and the last author is Costa. And this is coming from Edward Villa College of Osteopathic Medicine in Blacksburg, USA. And lastly, paper 16 was published in the Journal of Osteopathic Medicine. The authors mentioned that a previous pilot study showed improved spatial memory in rats following an osteopathic cranial manipulative medicine treatment, which I will refer to as cranial manipulation for the rest of this study. This is a continuation of that pilot study, in which the authors investigate whether this cranial manipulation can change the rat's gene expression. The study included 12 elderly rats, 6 of which were administered the procedure every day for 7 days. Following the treatment, RNA samples were extracted from the rat's brain tissue for a transcriptome analysis. The authors found that the transcranial manipulation significantly altered the expression of 36 genes related to neuronal function, with the 5 genes that showed the greatest change all being involved in cholinergic transmission. They also provide more detail on the other genes they identified, but overall these findings suggest that osteopathic cranial manipulation can induce gene expression changes that may relate to the previously reported biochemical and behavioral improvements seen in rats. So that is it for today. That was quite the tour de force from molecular level to human level to transgenic mice and rats and osteopathy and yeah, a lot that I put on your plate there. I hope you found it useful, accessible, and even a little bit interesting. And of course, I would like to thank everyone at aMinder, but in particular for this episode, I'd like to thank the sorting team, who went through all of the new abstracts in January, Anusha for reviewing my script and providing me with very useful feedback, Sarah for editing the audio. Anusha also reviewed the audio and is the creative soul behind our theme music. If you enjoy our little jingle, I encourage you to check out her other music at AK Music on YouTube or Anusha Kamesh on SoundCloud. And if you'd like to follow up on any of the papers we covered today, I encourage you to check out the bibliography, which was kindly prepared by Lara for this episode. So thank you for listening. If you have any feedback, please reach out to us on social media or feel free to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you're interested in joining our team to help us in our quest to facilitate Alzheimer's research, please send us an email with a quick note of how you'd like to contribute. And with that, I'm gonna enjoy my dinner, and I will be back here in a week's time with epidemiological and observational studies on risk and protective factors linked to AD. Have a wonderful week. Ciao.